PSI statistical mechanics. My name is Anton Burkov. So this will not be, of course, an ordinary StatMech course, because you are pretty advanced students. I will assume that the basics of statistical mechanics are known to you. So, you know, things like Gibbs distribution and theory of ideal gases. So I'll assume that you are fully proficient in that. If you feel deficient in any way, then this is something to take up with your tutor. I will not spend any time on this basic stuff. So instead, what we will focus on is theory of phases and phase transitions. So normally this is the subject that's covered in, you know, advanced statistical mechanics classes, but for you this will be your basic StatMech, okay? So it's one of the fundamental facts in physics that probably most of us know just from kind of everyday experience, that matter can exist in different phases. Or matter organizes itself in distinct phases. And, you know, the examples of that, again, we know just from everyday life, right? So probably the most well-known example to everybody is that nearly every substance can exist in either solid, liquid, or gas form, right, depending on temperature. So this is the most famous triad of phases, solid, liquid, gas. Another well-known example is that some materials like iron can be magnetic, meaning that they can have a spontaneous magnetic moment in the absence of any external magnetic field to magnetize them, while if you raise temperature, they become non-magnetic, okay? So ferromagnet paramagnet. That's another example. Another example is metal insulator, right? So there are materials which conduct electricity well, while others do not conduct electricity. So that's also an example of phases. Metal insulator. And so on. There are many, many other examples. So intuitively we kind of understand this, right? But so what does it mean more rigorously that matter organizes itself or exists in different phases? So more rigorously we can say that that phases, different phases of matter, are distinguished by certain robust macroscopic properties which either exist or not, okay? So phases, different phases of matter, are distinguished by certain macroscopic properties which exist in one phase but not in the other. And that's how we distinguish between different phases. So for example, here, what would be the property? So solid is distinguished from either liquid or a gas by the presence of this property which is called rigidity, right? So solid has rigidity, while liquid does not. So what does rigidity mean? It means that if I take, let's say, a solid rod, right, and I twist it on one end, this twist is going to be felt all the way to the other end, okay? While liquid does not have this property, I can shear a liquid without any effort. So distinction of liquid from gas. So what is the distinction of liquid from gas? The distinction is the presence of an interface, right? So if I put some amount of liquid in a container, right, that does not fill up the whole container, then there will be a well-defined interface between the liquid and the empty space above it. While a gas just fills up, as you know, all the available volume. Okay. So liquid has an interface. Well, I mean, how can you quantify rigidity, right? So it's sure you can, but the important point is that, you know, rigidity is either present or not. Okay, so liquid has an interface, while gas does not. So, ferromagnet has a macroscopic spontaneous magnetization, while paramagnet does not, and so on. Okay. So, ferromagnet has Now, okay, so kind of another fundamental idea is that the presence of such robust macroscopic properties that distinguish different phases, microscopically, this follows from ordering, what's called ordering. So let me lift this thing here. So, the presence of such robust properties which distinguish the phases is a consequence of what's called ordering. So again, let's talk about the simplest example of solid and liquid, right? So the rigidity of a solid is a consequence of the fact that if you look at the structure of the solid macroscopically, it's an ordered crystal lattice of atoms, right? So the atoms in a solid are ordered in a perfect crystal structure, okay? So rigidity of solid is a consequence of ordering of atoms, spontaneous ordering of atoms that, you know, comes from interactions between the atoms, ordering of atoms in a perfectly periodic crystal structure. So, you know, what does it mean? It means that, okay, so I have this, let me draw a cartoon of such a crystal structure, so the dots are atoms. And the point is that if I know the position of, let's say, one atom in this crystal structure, I will be able to predict with certainty the position of any atom infinitely far away from this point. Okay. While in the liquid, this prediction becomes impossible. So the positions of the atoms in the liquid, they may be kind of ordered on short scales, but if you go to long enough scales, the positions become completely random. Okay. Right. So another example is ferromagnetism. So the presence of a macroscopic magnetization in the magnet is a consequence of ordering of atomic magnetic moments in a crystal, right? So in a paramagnetic substance, the atomic magnetic moments are oriented more or less randomly, so that when you sum over all of them, the average, the total is zero. While in a ferromagnet, atoms, magnetic moments order along a particular direction. Okay, and so then the total magnetization is non-zero. So ferromagnetism of ordering of atomic magnetic moments. Okay, and so what we will be talking about in this class is basically this phenomenon of ordering and how order is lost when we have transitions between different phases. Okay, so let's start with the kind of the simplest model that exhibits this phenomenon of ordering. This model is called Ising model. So imagine that we have a cubic lattice of points in d dimensions. So the reason I want to keep dimensionality kind of as a parameter that I can change is that, as we will see later, dimensionality is going to play a very important role. You know, the properties of phase transitions depend crucially on dimensionality of space. So I want to keep dimensionality as a parameter. So I have cubic lattice in d dimensions. Right, and so on each side of this lattice, I will have the simplest possible degree of freedom. I will call this, I will label lattice sides by I. And so on each lattice side, I will have a degree of freedom. I will call it sigma I, which can take only two values, so plus or minus one. Right, so you can think for example, as a magnetic moment, okay, which can point either up or down. But more generally, you know, this is just a simplest possible degree of freedom, kind of like a qubit, right, which can take only two values. And so then I will assume that those degrees of freedom can interact with each other. So which will be described by the following Hamiltonian. It's minus 1/2 sum over all pairs of sides, I and j. So capital J, ij is going to be the strength of interaction between the spins. So I will call those degrees of freedom spins. But you know, they don't have to be spins, so any two, it's any two component degree of freedom. So j, ij is the strength of the interaction between spins on sides I and j, sigma j, and so this is it. Okay, so these degrees of freedom can interact pairwise, and the strength of this interaction is jij. Okay, so this is the simplest model you can imagine of interacting degrees of freedom. Right? So, as we will see, in any dimension D, which is greater than one, yeah. Well, I mean, self-interaction is going to be trivial, right? Because it's plus or minus one, the square is always one. So I can add, of course, self-interaction, but it's going to just add a trivial constant to the Hamiltonian. Right, so you know, so I can have jii, but the corresponding term in the Hamiltonian is just going to be, let's say, sum over I, jii, right? So this is just a constant; it does not depend on sigmas. Yeah. Later we will add a field that's going to couple to those spins, but for now let's just have it. Yeah.
Sorry, are there any constraints on what the number jij is or can be?
So far nothing. So let's assume that this is just a general interaction. So later we will talk about constraints on this interaction. Okay. Interaction just means that. So I have, so obviously the energy, the contribution to the energy, right, of a pair of spins depends on the relative orientation, right? That's what interaction is. Okay, so in any dimension which is greater than one, so d equals one is kind of special, but in any dimension greater than one, this model can exist in two phases. Which I call, by analogy with magnetism, I will call them ferromagnetic and paramagnetic. So, ferromagnetic and paramagnetic, and so they can be distinguished formally, rigorously, by what's called an order parameter. So, which kind of expresses mathematically this idea of ordering. So distinguished by order parameter, which I will call magnetization, and so I'll call it M, which is simply equal to thermal average of sigma I at any site, taken at any site I. So I will assume that this model is translationally invariant, okay, meaning that all sites are equivalent. So what that means is that this interaction here depends only on the distance between the sites, and it does not depend on the coordinate of a particular site. So then, certainly the average of any spin variable is going to be the same on all sides. Assuming translational symmetry, okay, and the average, so this is where your knowledge of the basics of statistical mechanics has to come in. So this is the standard statistical mechanical average. So it's one over the partition function, right? Trace, or, well, let me write it like this. Sum over all the possible configurations of those variables, right? Sigma I e to minus h divided by t, right? So I will always measure temperature in energy units. So they will not be a factor of KB here. Yeah.
Right.
So you know, all of this so far is classical. Okay, so there is no time dependence. So we are talking about equilibrium phases, right? So nothing depends on time.
Then what is the meaning of Hamiltonian?
Well, it's a classical Hamiltonian. This is energy. Okay, this is just energy. No. But so we will talk about this later. So you know, this concept of phase transitions can be generalized to quantum phase transitions, which happen at zero temperature as you change some parameter in the Hamiltonian, and so in that case, indeed, you get the way this can be obtained from this Hamiltonian is if I add another term, which let's say is proportional. So if these were, if these sigmas plus or minus one were, components of an actual spin, quantum mechanical spin along, let's say, z axis, right? So this would be sigma I z sigma j z. If I add another term to this Hamiltonian which does not commute, let's say some field times sigma x, right? So the Hamiltonian will actually contain two non-commuting terms. So that model would exhibit a quantum phase transition. We will talk about this later. Okay. So for now, everything is classical. Okay. Okay. So if we these phases are distinguished by, as I said, by this order parameter. So basically, M is not zero in the ferromagnetic phase and is exactly zero in the paramagnetic phase. Okay, so M is not zero in the ferromagnetic phase, and M is exactly zero in the paramagnetic phase. So if you were to plot. This thing. If you were to plot the dependence of this of magnetization M as a function of temperature, okay. So let's say starting from zero. So if you start at zero temperature, right? And let me assume I will always assume that. Those interactions JAJ, so that here comes the first restriction, those interactions are positive. Okay? So that means, because of this sign minus in front, so at zero temperature, all I want to do is just minimize the energy. Right? Obviously, to minimize the energy, what I have to do is make all the spins equal to either plus or minus one. Right? So that will maximize the magnitude of H and therefore minimize H. Because of the sign minus in front. So the magnetization at zero temperature has to be maximal and just equal to one, one or minus one. So, yeah.
But in the definition, you have the magnetization, like one of your loads, like at zero temperature, you've got two configurations.
So that's why I say it has to be either one or minus one. So we will talk about that. That's an important point. No, so it's a very good question, but so we will get to that. But it's a valid point. So let's say it's one, and so then as I increase temperature, thermal fluctuations will come in and diminish diminish M, and eventually. So the non-trivial thing is that eventually, at some well-defined temperature. Which I will call TC, the critical temperature, magnetization will actually vanish exactly. Okay, so it does not simply become small, let's say, but non-zero all the way to infinite temperature. It actually vanishes at a well-defined temperature. Okay. Sorry. Yeah. So this is d greater than one. Yeah. So what happens in one dimension is that this model is always in the paramagnetic phase. Okay. There is never at any finite temperature, magnetization is always zero. Okay. So you know this may seem kind of trivial, but that it's actually very non-trivial, right? So people for a long time did not believe that physical properties can behave in this kind of non-analytic manner, right? This is clearly a non-analytic function. M is a non-analytic function of T, right? It's non-zero here, but strictly zero above TC, okay? So as I said, people for a long time believed that such a behavior of physical properties cannot happen, okay? And it's actually related somewhat to your question, okay? Okay, so another important point is the following. So let's note that this Ising model Hamiltonian has the following property, that if I change, so for all sides I, if I perform the following transformation of the spins, if I simply change sigma I to minus sigma I, clearly H itself is invariant under this transformation, right? Because it involves interactions between the spins, sigma I and sigma j. So the minus signs are gonna cancel, okay? So what this means is that this sign change of all the spins is a symmetry of the Hamiltonian, right? So this is a symmetry of the Ising model, okay? However, the important point is that in the ferromagnetic phase, right, when I say that M has a well-defined value, that means also that M has a well-defined sign, right? Because if M could have, if sigmas could have both signs, right, then the average would be zero. So in the ferromagnetic phase, so what it means is that this symmetry of the Hamiltonian is violated, okay? M spontaneously chooses a particular sign. The spins spontaneously choose a particular direction in which to magnetize, okay? So in the ferromagnetic phase, this symmetry is violated spontaneously . That's an important point, meaning that you know, nothing forces the spins to choose one sign over the other, right? The sign is chosen spontaneously. So this is called spontaneously broken symmetry. And so ordering is always, not always, but in most cases, is connected to this idea of spontaneously broken symmetry, okay? Okay, so now let's do the following. Let's modify this model slightly. Let me actually add a field, which I will call magnetic field, which explicitly violates the symmetry, which prefers the spins to point in a particular direction or have a particular sign, plus or minus one. So let me raise this Sorry? Yeah, but I'll have to somehow I want you to see this one, but not.
There should be presets on the
Well, let's continue as it is. I'll figure this out later. Okay. So let me add this field. So I have minus 1/2 sum over I and j, j I j, sigma I, sigma j. And now let me add the following term, minus b, sum over I, sigma I, okay? And let me assume that b is positive, okay? So clearly this term prefers the spins to have value plus 1 rather than minus 1, right? Because the energy is lowered when sigma I's are equal to plus 1. So this prefers sigma I equals plus 1 and therefore violates explicitly violates the sigma I to minus sigma I symmetry explicitly, okay? Now, let me assume now that this system is finite, meaning that this cubic lattice has a finite number of sides. So let me call this number of sides N, capital N, so number of lattice sides. Okay. Now, so this sum, when I sum over all the lattice sides of all of the variables sigma I, approximately this term is going to be just equal to b times n times the average of sigma I, which is m, right? So I can write this Hamiltonian now in the following way. It's minus 1/2. Sum of I and j, jij, sigma I, sigma j, minus b times n times m, right? And now let me calculate the following. So let me calculate the relative probability for a state with positive m, which is preferred by this term, versus the state with negative m, which is not preferred by this term. Okay? Yeah. Well, yeah. So in the finite lattice, we have boundaries, obviously, right? But let's so we can still make it translationally invariant by using what's called periodic boundary conditions, right? So it's not important here, but we will actually often use that. So imagine that I have, for example, just a chain of sides. So this is one-dimensional lattice, right? So the way I can deal with the presence of boundaries is that I can bend this chain into a circle. Now, so this still has full translational invariance, right? Because if I rotate by one lattice spacing, I get the same system, okay?
Why does a partition function have some boundary conditions?
Sorry?
Is your partition function defined with some boundary conditions?
The point is that as long as this number of size n is large enough, right? Then boundary conditions don't matter, right? Because even if you have open boundaries, let's say in one-dimensional case, there are only two spins in the boundary at the boundaries. which is much smaller for a long chain than the number of spins in the interior. And so what happens at the boundaries doesn't really matter. We can just choose boundary conditions which are convenient. Okay.
And I'm asking why you need boundary conditions, because you are still some over there.
No, I don't. I mean, the question was, you know, if this assumption of finite number of sites violates translational invariance, which I have assumed before. And the point is that it really doesn't. I can choose periodic boundary conditions, and then it, translational symmetry is preserved. But it's not, well, it's not really important for.
The periodic boundary condition doesn't seem invariant. Oh, sorry.
Okay, it's not invariant under, of course, there is no invariance even in an infinite system. The invariance is with respect to translations by one lattice spacing, right? It's not continuous translational symmetry. Okay, so let me calculate this probability. So let me call probability for a state with negative m, p, m less than 0, relative to probability of a state with p with m greater than 0, which is preferred by this term. So what's it going to be? Well, it's just going to be the ratio. I mean, the only term in the Hamiltonian that cares about the sine of m is this one, right? So therefore, this probability is just going to be given by the ratio of the corresponding Boltzmann weights, right? So this will be, let me call this e to less than 0. So let me call this e to minus n b absolute value of m divided by t, right? Divided by the same exponential but with a plus sign, divided by t. So this is just equal to e to minus 2n b absolute value of m divided by t, right? And now let me do the following. So let me keep this n fixed and send the magnitude of this field to 0, right? So keep n fixed while sending b to 0. So clearly, if I keep n fixed and send b to 0, this ratio is going to go to 1, right? So then this ratio in this, let me write it like this. So limit of, so I first take the limit of b going to 0. And after that, I might as well send n to infinity, right? But only after I send b to 0. Okay, so I use this order of limits. First I send b to 0 and then n to infinity. So this limit of the ratio is equal to 1, right? So what does it mean? It means that in this situation, the probability of having m equals plus 1 or of m being positive and m being negative, probabilities are equal. Therefore, on average, m should be 0, right? Since both signs are equally probable, right? And we are summing over all possible configurations in the partition when we calculate the partition function, right? So average value of the order parameter should be zero. Or so this means that in such a situation, M is actually equal to zero. However, now let me take those limits in the opposite order. Okay, so if, let me first take the limit n going to infinity, and only then take the limit of b going to zero. Okay. So clearly, in this case, right, as long as b is non-zero, right, even if it's infinitesimally small, in the limit when n is infinite, this ratio will always be equal to zero. Right. And so if I use this order of limits, the ratio of those probabilities is going to be equal to zero. Okay. And so in this case, in the limit when my system size is going to infinity, I will actually have a well-defined order parameter of a particular sign, positive in this case, because I've chosen b to be positive, right? But the point is that this order parameter will have that particular sign even when I take this external field, which chooses, which breaks explicitly the symmetry of the Hamiltonian and chooses a particular sign, even in this limit, the sign will stay the same. Okay? So in this limit, m is not going to be equal to zero. Okay? So what this illustrates is a very important point that you know, both phases and phase transitions are kind of mathematically well defined only in the limit when the system size is infinite. Okay. So phases and phase transitions are well defined mathematically only in the limit and in the limit when the number of degrees of freedom which interact is infinite. Okay, so this is also called thermodynamic limit. And so, you know, this is what confused people for a long time about this this behavior, right? Because so if you take any finite system, it's pretty clear that such non-analytic behavior of physical quantities is impossible, right? Yeah.
So in physical systems, why we tend to see like phase transitions look like phase transitions is because the fluctuations happen over really large time scales.
Exactly. Yeah. So of course, real systems are never infinite, right? There is always some large, but still finite number of degrees of freedom. But the point is that to actually see consequence of this fact that the two signs of M are equally probable, you have to wait for a really long time. Okay. Yeah.
I think I missed some point for the second term in the Hamiltonian. Why can we write that as B and M?
Well, because you know, so if I sum sigma i's, if my lattice is large enough, right? If I sum sigma i's over all the lattice sites, this this sum is going to be equal with a you know, degree of precision that increases with the size of the system to just n times the average value of sigma. Okay, but this is only true if n is large enough.
Claiming that these two different ways of taking limits actually correspond to two different phases that we are seeing in that graph?
No, the point here is that so you know, if I keep the size of the system finite, right, while eliminating this field that picks the two parts, the one of the signs, then the both signs are equally probable, and so M has to be zero. Okay, so the point is that you know, this behavior of this phenomenon of spontaneously broken symmetry only happens in an infinite system. That's the point. Okay. Okay. So yeah.
I'm still unclear about in both the systems. In both the cases, you're taking n goes to infinite. It's just the order of.
Right. It's just the order that matters.
What does the order physically correspond to?
Well, I don't know what it corresponds to physically. I mean, so the point is that so this field B, right? So this prefers a particular sign of the order parameter. Okay, and so but what we are interested in, of course, is the spontaneous ordering, which happens in the absence of the field. Okay, and so what I want to do is I have this field initially, so that picks a particular direction for me, but then I want to eliminate the field, send its value to zero, and see if the ordering still survives in the absence of the field.
Does that case correspond to something like you don't have any field, but you take an infinite system?
So this case corresponds to I keep the system finite and let the field vanish. Let the field go to zero, and in this case, if I observe the system over a long enough time scale, the average value of M will always be zero.
And in that case, you have a field, and then you eliminate it.
And in this case, I first send the size of the system to infinity, right? And only then I send the field to zero. So basically, you know, again, so you can think in terms of the time scale. So physically, this corresponds to. You know, here for any finite system size, there will always be a finite time scale over which M is going to average to zero. While here, this time scale is infinite because the size of the system is infinite.
You need to have a field to start with and then eliminate.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. The reason I need the field is I want to choose one of the signs, right? One versus minus one, plus versus minus. Sorry. Okay, so now, so this was all kind of generalities. Let's now try to describe this phenomenon quantitatively. So in particular, what I want to describe is how exactly that order parameter vanishes as a function of temperature, okay? And so let us start with the simplest description. Of this phenomenon, which will turn out to be completely inadequate, right? But it's a start. Okay. So the simplest description is called mean field theory. Okay, so the idea is the following. So, you know, why can't I just take this Hamiltonian and just solve it exactly? Meaning, why can't I just evaluate the partition function exactly? Well, what makes it complicated is the fact that the spins on different sides interact. Okay, so in principle, this model can be solved exactly, but only in some specific cases. So it's relatively simple to do in one dimension, and perhaps you will actually go over this solution in your homework or tutorials, and then you can see that in one dimension there is no phase transition. So the average of sigma is always zero. It can also be solved exactly, but this is much more difficult in two dimensions. Okay, so this was done by Lars and Zager in the 1940s, and so that exact solution was actually very important in convincing people finally that this kind of behavior is actually possible, meaning the non-analytic behavior of the order parameter as a function of temperature. But in general, already in three dimensions, this model cannot be solved exactly, unfortunately. Okay, so we have to use approximations in general to study this. And you know, this model is basically the simplest one you can imagine. Certainly, in more complicated models, you can't even solve them in one and two dimensions. Yeah. Solving just means that I can, if I can evaluate the partition function, right, which is the sum over all configurations of e to minus h over t, whether I can evaluate it exactly, right, analytically. So if I know this, that I can calculate all thermodynamic properties. Well, dimension is the dimension of this lattice, right? So,
yeah, I'm just wondering how the dimension is
incorporated into the Hamiltonian. Is that true? Well, so this sum is only defined relative to. So I have to put my spins on some particular lattice, right? They're not defined in continuous space. I define them on sides of a lattice, and so the dimensionality of the lattice is implicitly in this Hamiltonian. Yeah. Sorry?
Did Onsager's solution for nearest neighbors?
Probably, yeah. So, you know, for now I'm going to keep this general. But, yeah, in principle, later we'll probably simplify this to just nearest neighbors. Yeah.
So, can you do IC models for like larger than three dimensions analytically?
Well, right. So, as we will see, in fact, if dimensionality is greater than four, then this mean field theory here is in fact exact. Well, in the sense that it describes the what happens near TC exactly. Okay, so really, you know, the only dimensionality that's difficult, as far as this model is concerned, at least, is three. But three is exactly what we are interested in. So. Okay, so how does this work? So let me write my spin sigma I in the following way, as sigma I minus its average value, and then plus its average value. Okay. So basically, sigma I minus m plus m. And so then, what I will assume is that this deviation of any instantaneous value of any value of sigma I that you actually observe from its average value is small. Okay. So let's assume that this is small. Okay, so what I can do then is, I can rewrite my sigma i's in this way in the Hamiltonian, and then neglect all the terms in the Hamiltonian which are quadratic in this deviation. Okay, so no, so I have what? No, it does not. I will still leave, terms which are linear in sigma I. So there will still be some non-trivial dependence or some dependence of the Hamiltonian on sigma i's. Okay. Yeah.
The sigma i's are still all plus or minus one, though, right?
Yeah,
whereas
yeah.
M is some real number.
Yes. Yeah, it's a good point. Yeah. So what this actually means, that this deviation is small, is unclear. Okay.
Yeah.
And so we will fix that problem later when we talk about how to improve mean field theory. For now, what this will mean is simply that I will neglect terms which are quadratic in this deviation. Okay. So, okay, so let's say I have sigma I and sigma j, so that's one term in this Hamiltonian, then so I have sigma I minus m plus m times sigma j minus m plus m, right? So this is equal to, we go here, sigma I minus m times sigma j minus m, and so this I will actually neglect, then plus m sigma I minus m, right, plus sigma j minus m, and plus m squared, okay? And so, as I said, this quadratic term I'm going to neglect, and this is approximately equal to m times sigma I plus sigma j, and then minus 2 m squared plus m squared. So this is m times sigma I plus sigma j, and then minus m squared, okay? And so let me take this and plug this into the Hamiltonian. This. Okay, and so now I'll have H equals minus 1/2. By the way, this factor of 1/2, you understand, it just corrects for double counting of pairs, right? So minus 1/2 sum over I and j, j I j, then I have m times sigma I plus sigma j, right? And then plus 1/2 sum over I and j, j I j times m squared, okay? Now, let me define the following thing. Let me call this capital J without any indices the sum over, let's say, j or I, it doesn't matter, of these interaction strength J I J, okay? So this is independent of I, precisely for this reason that that I'm assuming that the lattice is translationally invariant. So all sides in this lattice are equivalent, okay? And I will assume also that this interaction is short range enough so that this sum is finite, okay? So assume J is finite. So then this Hamiltonian becomes simply minus J times M, right? Sum of I, sigma I, right? And then plus j times m squared. Okay, this is just some constant term, but I'm going to keep it since it depends on m. Sorry, of course, this must be proportional to the number of sides. So this is going to be plus, 1/2 n times j times m squared. Right. again, so here I am taking the total number of sites in the slices to be finite. Yeah. So yeah, if the sum does not, did not converge, then this would be complicated. So this just means that the interactions are very long range, in which case, well, it's a special case. So you want.
Are there any physical systems where that sum doesn't
Well, not really, you know. So even, let's say, you can say that, you know, suppose I just take particles which interact through Coulomb interactions, right? Coulomb interactions decay is 1 over r, and so that would be long range, right? If you just were summing, this would be infinite. But in fact, in reality, there is this phenomenon that's called screening, right? So if you have a system of charged particles, they kind of reorganize themselves in such a way that the effective interaction is actually short range. And so, you know, but even kind of so in most physical systems, the interactions would be, or the effective interactions would be short range. And, you know, even sort of philosophically, this is what we would be most interested in, right? We want to see how ordering on infinite scales arises from only short range interactions, right? You know, if you have interactions which are really long range, then maybe this phenomenon would not be as surprising, right? If particles can interact over infinite scales, then maybe it's easier to imagine that they should know about each other.
Is this one of the problems with the strong force?
Right. Well, I mean, in the strong force, what happens is that you know, the interaction actually grows with distance, right? So. Yeah, that certainly is a special case, but so you know, I'm not going to talk about anything like that, but there is a phenomenon in this particular system that's also kind of can be described using statistical mechanics ideas, although it's not. It's called confinement. There is a confinement, deconfinement transition there, but it's a special case in the sense that it's not described by this idea of an order parameter. It's a different kind of transition.
In the last expression you wrote for the Hamiltonian, I'm not sure how you resolved the first term.
So what I'm assuming here is that, you know, so this sum over I and j, so, you know, I can, let's say, take the first term, right? That's going to give me 1/2 of this, right? But then, so in the second term, I will just rename my summation indices, I to j, and that's going to give me the same thing. So it's 1/2 plus 1/2. That gives me 1, right? Okay? Okay, so now what makes this, and so unlike the original exact Ising model, this we can easily solve. Okay, again, in the sense that I have mentioned, we can easily calculate the partition function of this model because this is just a bunch of independent sigma i's, right, that exist in some external field which is equal to j times m. Okay, so let's calculate this partition function now. So z is again sum over all configurations of sigmas of e to minus h divided by t. Okay, and so this I can write in the following way as so sum over all configurations of e to plus j m divided by t, right? Sum over I sigma I, and then I can separate out this constant factor. So e to minus n j m squared divided by 2t, right? So since this is a sum of exponentials or exponential of a sum, right, I can write this as a product of exponentials. So this is equal to e to minus n j m squared divided by 2t. And then I have product over all I from 1 to n, right? And then inside that product sum over sigma I, and each sigma I can take two values, plus or minus 1, of e to j m divided by t sigma I, right? So this is equal to e to minus n j m squared divided by 2t, right? And then I have, so the sum, once I sum, yeah.
Are you sure you've got the same number of combinations in both sums? Because over the first one, like, you're taking all possible combinations of... Oh, no,
yeah, I mean, all possible combinations just mean all possible values for any site, right? So the number of configurations, you know, in the kind of exact partition function as here is the same. It's just that the Hamiltonian is simplified. So once I sum over the two values of sigma I, right, this no longer depends on I. So this will just give me whatever I get after summing taken to the power n, right? And so what I get, okay, so let me just write it. So it's e to jm divided by t for sigma I equals plus 1, right? Plus e to minus jm over t for sigma I equals minus 1. And this is taken to the power n. And so this I can just write as twice the hyperbolic cosine of this argument, right? So this is equal to e to minus n j m squared divided by 2t. And then, so hyperbolic cosine of, twice the hyperbolic cosine of j times m divided by t taken to the power n, okay? So this is my partition function now. And so from this I can calculate, for example, the Helmholtz free energy. So let me erase this. Call it F, and so this is equal, as you know, minus T log of the partition function, and so this gives me so just NJ M squared over 2 over 2, right, and then so minus T minus t log of twice the hyperbolic cosine of j t of j m divided by t. There is a factor of n in front, minus t times n, okay? So the free energy, of course, is always proportional to n, right? Because it's an extensive quantity. Okay, so now, okay, this is not all, of course, because So we have this this free energy depends on order parameter m, right, which we don't know, right? What we are actually interested in is finding how m depends on temperature. So to do that, what I have to do is minimize this free energy as a function of m. Okay. So let's minimize f as a function of m. So I want to calculate the derivative of f with respect to m and then set it to zero. This is going to give me an equation for m. Okay. Okay. So let's calculate the derivative. So d f dm is equal to n times j times m. Okay. And so the derivative of this horrible function log of hyperbolic cosine is just a hyperbolic tangent, right? Because I get 1 over cosine when differentiating the log, and then derivative of the hyperbolic cosine is a sine, is a hyperbolic sine. So then I get minus n times j times hyperbolic tangent of jm divided by t. And so I want to set it to zero. Okay. No, the factor of 2 is going to cancel, you know, between the numerator and denominator, right? Or, you know, a log of a product is sum of logs. So that factor of 2 is actually unimportant. It just gives me an additive correction to the free energy that does not depend on m. Okay? Yeah.
In t? No, never mind. Yeah, I got it.
T also?
Yeah,
that's correct.
Yeah, because the inside comes. Yeah, I got it.
Okay. Okay, so now this gives me an equation for m. I can cancel n times j. The equation that determines in mean field theory how m depends on temperature is this. So m equals hyperbolic tangent of jm divided by t. Okay. So, well, it's a nonlinear equation. So in general, I can't really solve it analytically, although we will be able to solve it analytically in some special cases, in particular near the critical temperature, but we can always solve it numerically or graphically, sorry, numerically or graphically. So let me kind of attempt to solve it graphically. So to do that, I have to plot, you know, the left-hand side and the right-hand side of those of this equation as a function of m, right? And then the intersections of the two curves are going to give me the solutions. Well, so the left-hand side is just a straight line. As a function of m that cuts my plane at 45 degrees, right? And then so the right-hand side, okay, so how does hyperbolic tangent behave? When m is going to zero, it goes to zero, right? And then at infinity, hyperbolic tangent goes to one, right? One or minus one. Okay, so if m is going to plus infinity, it's one. If m is going to minus infinity, it's minus one. So then something like this, I have one here and minus one here. And so I have a function that converges to one and then to minus one at plus and minus infinity, right? And so the solutions of this equation are the intersection points, right? So there is always this solution corresponding to m equals 0, okay? And then, so in the situation which I've drawn here, there are also two non-trivial solutions. Let me call this plus m0 and minus m0. Okay, so they have to be equal by magnitude. You know, and that just reflects the symmetry of this free energy with respect to changing the sign of m, which in turn is a consequence of the, you know, sigma to minus sigma symmetry of the Hamiltonian, right? Now, so what actually determines whether I have those two solutions with non-zero value of m? So what determines it is, as you can see from this graph, is the slope of the tangent of jm over t at m equals 0 relative to the slope of this straight line, which is 1. So if the slope, like it's drawn here, if the slope is greater than 1, right, then there will be two non-trivial solutions, this m equals plus minus m0. However, if the slope is less than 1, so if the tangent behaves like this, then the only non-trivial, the only solution is m equals 0, which corresponds to the paramagnetic phase. Yeah.
And when you have the two solutions, m and minus m,
then the minimum in solution 0 is the maximum, right?
Yeah, so I have not actually shown that this corresponds to a minimum of the free energy. I've only extremized it. But yeah, they actually do correspond to a minimum. We will discuss it later. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So then, and the slope of the tangent near m equals 0 is just this ratio j over t, right? So tangent, hyperbolic tangent of j m over t near m equals 0 behaves as just j m divided by t, right? And so the slope, therefore, is just j divided by t, okay? So when j over t is greater than 1, then I have non-trivial, meaning non-zero, solutions, and so this corresponds to a ferromagnetic phase. While when j over t is less than 1, so j over t less than 1, only m equals 0 is the solution. And so this corresponds to paramagnetic phase of my Isaac model. And so therefore, the critical temperature is equal to J, okay? So the critical temperature at which the transition from the ferromagnetic to the paramagnetic phase happens is just equal to J. So let me erase this. Well, okay. So the point is that you know, it's related to your question actually, that what I found here is just an extremum of the free energy, right? So this condition is satisfied at either minimum of the free energy or maximum. So the point is that not all of those solutions correspond to a minimum. Okay, so when plus and minus M0 are solutions, they correspond to a minimum, and then this one is actually maximum. While when I have only one solution, M equals 0, this corresponds to a minimum. So we will see this in just a few minutes.
In parameter.
No, the point is that those three solutions cannot correspond to a minimum of the free energy simultaneously. Okay, that's the. Okay, so I get TC equals J, okay. And so if you were actually to solve this equation numerically, which is easy to do, then we would find that, so let's say we pick a particular solution with a positive sign, right? It would be equal to 1 at t equals 0, and then it would vanish continuously at tc, which is equal to j, okay? So important point here is that m is a continuous function of temperature always. It's non-analytic, but it's continuous. And so such phase transitions for which the order parameter is a continuous function of temperature or whatever the parameter you change to induce a phase transition. So such phase transitions are called second order or continuous phase transitions. So M is a continuous function of t, so this is a continuous or second order phase transition. So it's also possible in principle that M, that order parameter, could be a discontinuous function of temperature. So it could behave like this. It changes continuously up to TC, and then it simply jumps to 0, okay? So this is also possible, and such transitions are called first order. So first order or discontinuous . So we will be mostly interested in this type of phase transitions. Okay, so both are actually common in nature. In fact, probably this one is more common than the continuous transition, but the continuous transitions are much more interesting theoretically. Okay, for reasons that you will understand later. Yeah.
There's no such thing as a phase transition, right?
There are, I guess, so this classification, you know, first order or second order, is kind of outdated. I guess the modern language is the continuous or discontinuous. This just refers to, you know, which derivative of the free energy exhibits singularity at the transition. Okay, so in principle, they can be transitions of any order, of infinite order. Okay. But the distinction, really, the important distinction is this continuous or discontinuous. And while there can also be transitions which are not described by in this language at all, meaning that transitions which are not described by an order parameter, okay, which we will also talk about later. Okay.
What difference in the properties do you observe when it's a discontinuous transition?
Sorry?
What difference in the properties of the system do you observe if it's a...
Well, it's just, you know, so if order parameter vanishes discontinuously, then it's discontinuous, okay? But physically, you know, so the reason that you will see that we are interested in continuous transitions rather than discontinuous is because these possess this property of universality, where, you know, seemingly microscopically different systems will actually have identical properties near the phase transition. Okay, and it's this universality that makes them interesting theoretically.
First orders are more common, so some examples.
Well, I don't know. Solid, liquid, solid transitions are mostly. I mean, in fact, you know, majority of the transitions, I would say, observed in nature are actually first order. Yeah. So.
First order phase transitions have a latent heat.
Yeah. So
the second order doesn't, right?
Right. So one kind of observable difference is that. There is a latent heat associated with first order transitions, but not with second order. Yeah.
Yeah. But then another property of first order phase transitions is that distinct phases can exist in equilibrium.
Right. So that's another property that right at the transition point, you will actually have the ordered phase and the disordered phase kind of coexisting. Yeah. Yeah.
For this discontinuous transformation, there doesn't exist any correspondence with QFT at the critical point?
Right. So that's another thing that's interesting about continuous transitions is that...
Are there any models where you can find some correspondence with some QFT for these kinds of cases?
For first order transitions.
Right.
Well, I mean, you can, as we'll see, I mean, okay, so this is the good point, and in fact, I will emphasize connections between continuous phase transitions and quantum field theory, which I guess you are taking at the same time, right? So in principle, one can write down field theories for also for first order phase transitions as long as this jump is small enough, okay? But they don't have this, you know, particularly nice property of continuous phase transitions is that you know, there is this universality that emerges right at TC. So that's not the case for first order transitions.
So as long as you have a QFT description, it seems to me that you will have universality.
No, well, it's not. Okay, so it's not. So it's not going to be a QFT description in the sense that you know, it looks like a relativistic quantum field theory for some boson, right? For a massless boson. The point is that you can write down an expansion for the free energy in powers of the order parameter that looks like, at first sight, like a QFT, but it's not. You will see what I mean later. Yeah.
At which step in the derivation have we used that we are in the thermodynamic limit?
That's a good point. So we have not actually. Okay. So mean field theory is in fact insensitive to all of those issues. I guess the only place where I'm using this implicitly is that I'm assuming that M is not zero, right? And that I'm assuming that I can pick a particular sign of M, but I don't have to average over the two signs of M. That's where I'm assuming implicitly that we are in thermodynamic limit, but you know that equation, the mean field equations by themselves are not sensitive to the size of the system. That's a good point, and you know this is one of the reasons why why mean field theory does not actually work, okay, except in high dimensions. Okay.
So why do you not have to average?
Well, so I'm assuming that I don't have to do that. I'm assuming that I've taken thermodynamic limit, and then...
Do you not have to do that in thermodynamic limit?
Well, so that was this argument that, you know, if I add the field to this free energy, right, that chooses a particular sign of M for me, and I take the order of limits in a particular order, right? First field to zero, first n to infinity and then field to zero, then actually the probability of the wrong sign of m is going to be zero relative to the right sign. Okay? Okay, so let's continue now. So, actually I'm out of time, so let's continue next time, okay, tomorrow.